Hello and welcome to another episode of the Daily Remedy Podcast. Today I want to discuss something that has really been making the news in more than one way, just not as obvious as we would like to perceive it. And that is the inability for healthcare laws to actually reflect the underlying clinical medicine. We see that during the recent abortion laws in Texas. And we see that with the latest set of indictments released by the Department of Justice for telemedicine fraud. Now, before we begin, let me give you an example that would really help set the context. When Sir Isaac Newton, yes, the physicist, when Sir Isaac Newton was sitting under the tree, an apple fell on his head. And that's the anecdote generally told for how Newton came up with the concept of gravity. And every physicist and every mathematician subsequent to Newton created theorems and formulas based on the law of gravity. If there was a physicist or mathematician who came up with the law saying, you know, gravity works in reverse. As a matter of fact, we don't move closer to the center of the Earth. We move farther away, then that law or formula would not apply because it is not in accordance to the underlying law of gravity. The same thing with the law of thermodynamics. In traditional sciences, whenever we make an advancement, either with a discovery, a new formula, a new invention, they always fall in line with the underlying principles and established funds of knowledge. As a matter of fact, the same thing applies to the laws. The Constitution is based upon the common law system, which is a British form of law, in which we have courts, we have the separation of the government from the courts, and that separation is designed to help protect individual rights. And should a civil or criminal case appear before the courts, the federal government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that that particular individual is either civilly liable or criminally culpable. There are set standards and protocols for which the common law system is based upon. And the series of rulings, court case after court case, comes to define what is known as case law. The Constitution is based upon common law, and so we in America also have a common law based upon case law. This is why we keep referring to jurisprudence and case law here, and talking about medical jurisprudence seems to be a habit here at Daily Remedy, but it's for a reason. Because how the court interprets the laws, how the court understands public perception of the laws, determines how well the laws reflect the public's understanding of healthcare. So then the question becomes, why do healthcare laws not adapt to the underlying clinical science or medical literature? Why do we have so many laws that seem to hurt patients more than help them? We discussed earlier about the moralization of laws based upon pre-existing ethical principles. We discussed how a lot of people conflate morality with medicine, and that in turn causes people to accept laws in healthcare that may not be in the patient's best interest. But if we were to just focus on the medicine itself, the objective medical literature and clinical standards of care, even within that world, we find that there's an abundance of healthcare laws that simply do not maintain standards as defined according to clinical medicine. And this is for a reason. The law in America has traditionally relied upon legal reviews, legal briefs, basically prominent attorneys opining their opinion And if the lawyer is prominent enough and the opinion is repeated enough times, that opinion essentially becomes case law. Now, there was one Supreme Court justice that really helped to turn the tide away from this concept of relying on legal briefs. And he was a bit of a contentious justice for his time. He was the first Jewish American Supreme Court justice. And I'm sure most of you know who I'm alluding to. It's Supreme Court Justice Brandeis. There are many universities and institutions named after him, but few can actually recall what his main contribution to the legal system was. Well, his main contribution was the introduction of facts and data into the legal circles. As absurd as that may sound, it was groundbreaking at the time, the start of the 20th century. So we're dealing with the late 1890s, the early 1900s. It was a very unique time in American history. We had prohibition. Women were still struggling for the right to vote, still struggling for equality. And we had laws that really discriminated against select minorities, be it both African Americans and women, using false understandings of clinical science, of race theory, to uphold discriminatory policies. Well, Supreme Court Justice Brandeis came in, and he pioneered what was known as the Brandeis Brief. It's a legal brief that essentially relies upon scientific information and social sciences to justify a clinical position. He first introduced this type of brief when advocating for women's right to work. There were certain laws that were prohibiting women from working a certain number of hours and putting undue burdens upon women based upon their working conditions. And Brandeis was able to prove scientifically that those laws were imposing undue burdens. Before that, women would be subjected to all sorts of horrendous work conditions. And if you Google it, you'll see all sorts of horror stories of women in just horrendous working conditions, subject to abuse from their bosses, subject to ungodly work hours. All of these things were emanating from healthcare laws that did not respect and understand the woman's right to work and what are appropriate working conditions. Now, nowadays, we have OSHA, we have a whole plethora of laws that have really dissected this issue into social policy and labor rights. But these laws were really enacted out of this Brandeis brief that recognized we have to use the social sciences and established scientific literature to initiate any law that would be constitutional with women's right to work as they should work and given the constraints, biological, and constraints social that women have to go through while working and living their lives, maintaining their family, establishing a support structure. All of these are very realistic constructs that go into what are undue burdens for women in the work conditions. It seemed obvious, but at the time, it was anything but. As a matter of fact, it was controversial. And this matches really something that has been a broad theme throughout American history. Science and law have been so incompatible that when law matches science, the lawyer who introduces that becomes a Supreme Court justice. Now, we can look at that very sarcastically, but all jokes aside, there is an incredible lack of medical standards in legal cases. In fact, the concept of standard of care has been defined more by juries and lawyers than by physicians themselves. In fact, there is a precedent of legal supremacy in the medical interpretation of standards of care, which really for many years has adversely affected healthcare. In fact, there was one case that was adjudicated over by none other than Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who is a bit of a favorite here at Daily Remedy. But in this case, he ruled in a way that was a bit suspicious. This was the case of Helling v. Carey, in which the patient Helling sues an eye surgeon, Carey, for the loss of her eyesight due to glaucoma. The surgeon decided that the glaucoma needed to be treated surgically. The patient, subsequent to an adverse outcome, sued the surgeon, stating that he made a wrong decision. Now, what had happened was the case eventually ruled that, according to Oliver Wendell Holmes, what is usually done, standard of care, may be evidence of what ought to be done, but what ought to be done is fixed by a standard of reasonable prudence, whether it is compiled with or not. Now, it sounds nice. It's very good wordplay and very typical of Oliver Wendell Holmes, but essentially it established a ruling that whatever is evidence can be evidence, and whatever is not evidence is not evidence. It's an inherently subjective way to look at medical standards of care. Now, was glaucoma surgery the appropriate clinical standard for this particular patient? We'll never know. The underlying medical history has been lost to the annals of time. But the manner in which this case was adjudicated upon was decidedly subjective and not based upon any evidence-based guidelines for how glaucoma should be treated. There is no discourse in there about medical treatments for glaucoma or surgical treatments for glaucoma. It was simply insinuated that whatever is evidence and whatever is usual procedure, and we leave it at that. Essentially, the ruling in Helling v. Carey prompted states all over the country to pass laws that define the standard of care more in legal terms than in medical terms, and more subjectively than objectively. And one example, which is most egregious, actually comes from the state of Washington, where they define standard of care or lack thereof when the defendant or defendants fail to exercise degree of skill, care, and learning possessed by other persons in the same profession. That is an inherently subjective criteria, because one medical expert may say that does represent appropriate standard of care, and another expert may say, no, it does not. When you leave the decision-making for standard of care in the hands and mouths of other physicians, it becomes subjective. Their idea was, well, let's not have the lawyers decide. Let's have the physicians decide. But there's no objective criteria or standard by which that metric, standard of care, can be met. Again, it's just kicking the ball from a lawyer to a physician, but keeping the definition inherently subjective. Now, the good news is that we are becoming a bit more objective and clinically sound when we present more recent cases of standard of care in front of the legal courts. There's a case in 1985, Hall v. Hilbun, in which a patient presents to the physician for abdominal pain. The surgeon does what surgeons do and initiated a procedure in the operating room. The details show that appropriate standard of care was maintained, but the patient passed, sadly, regardless, due to unforeseeable post-surgical complications. The case then eventually made its way to the federal courts, and essentially, two witnesses were used to then determine what is national standard of care for surgeons. But these witnesses provided an inherently subjective interpretation, and when their interpretations were presented to court, they were then used against the physician, and the physician was deemed not to have maintained standard of care based upon the interpretation of those two expert witnesses. There is no review on the surgical procedure, no review on the post-operative orders initiated by the surgeon, or whether the complication that led to the patient's death was unforeseeable or not related to the actual surgery itself. It was simply insinuated by these two witnesses that the physician, that the surgeon in question did not provide minimally competent care. And according to the law in which this case was decided on, all that is required is the verification that minimal competence was not met. And then by that logic, the surgeon becomes culpable. The broader issue here is a general trend of laws using subjective metrics to monitor liability and culpability. It emanates from a broader trend where the law is not taking into account the appropriate standards of care, nor is adjudicated based upon underlying standards of care. It always tries to find some sort of workaround. It always tries to find some method by which it can simplify the complexities of medical care, either through a simplified law or through some third-party interpretation. It's essentially triangulating expert witnesses to claim liability or criminal culpability as opposed to the standards of care themselves. This is why many laws appear retaliatory in nature, and why the abortion laws that pervade this country never take into account the medical fundamentals of abortion. They simply find some action item related to abortion that's quantifiable enough to base a law around, and then create a law that would either restrict or remove restrictions when it comes to the legality of abortion. These laws are fundamentally retaliatory and punitive in nature. They appear as responses to trends, not to the clinical science itself. So if we see a trend of too many abortions in an area, we restrict it. If we see a rise in too many telemedicine visits, we identify instances of fraud. The law always behaves in a fundamentally reactive manner when it comes to healthcare behavior, because the law does not possess the ability to understand healthcare behavior to the extent needed to contextualize healthcare behavior within a legal framework. This problem is only going to get worse, and it's only going to increase the divide between healthcare and law. Because the more complex healthcare becomes, the more we understand subtle discriminatory patterns in patient behavior, be it vaccine disparities between different races, we are now going to depart further from the existing laws. And the greater the departure between healthcare behavior and healthcare laws, the more reactive and punitive the healthcare laws become. Healthcare laws now are seen to be retaliatory in nature relative to the progress made in healthcare. Last year, telemedicine was legal. Last year, telemedicine went to levels unforeseen in decades because of the pandemic. But the moment it became too popular, it became criminalized. And that's what we're seeing with this first indictment against telemedicine under the aegis of healthcare fraud. It's important to watch this case closely because it's the first case against telemedicine and will set the standard for how novel therapies and therapeutics using new forms of digital communication are criminalized and adjudicated in the court of law, and will set the precedent for how digital technologies will impact patient care going forward, because how the law influences healthcare behavior, so then goes individual patient behavior relative to those laws. So with that, I wish you all a good day and talk to you guys next time. Thank you.